10:30, back to the screen. Just right, just right, just right. About what? About what? About a man getting on a bus somewhere in the Midwest. A lean, graying man in a cheap windbreaker who's been forced to leave the family farm to get a job in Omaha. And as he settles into his seat, he's thinking about his widowed mother, or maybe it's his wife, and the cows in the barn, and the chickens in the what do you call it? The hen house.
Welcome to Book Tour. I'm Lynn Neary. Emily Fox Gordon has written about her early life in two memoirs. Mockingbird Years is the story of the time she spent as a teenager at a mental hospital and the unorthodox therapist who helped her. Her second memoir, Are You Happy?, is about her childhood in the college town of Williamstown, Massachusetts in the 1950s. Now, in her first novel, It Will Come to Me, Fox Gordon borrows from both life experiences. Set on a college campus in Texas, it's a humorous and perceptive look at the academic life. But as narrator Ruth Blau tries to revive her long-dormant writing career, she also copes with the tragedy of her mentally ill son. Emily Fox Gordon read from It Will Come to Me at the McNally Jackson Bookstore on March 23rd. Afterwards, she discussed the novel with her editor, Julie Grau, senior vice president and publisher of Spiegel & Grau.
Yeah, thank you all so much for coming out tonight. I'm going to just read a tiny bit, which may not be all that representative because it only involves one of the characters, and it involves not academic life, but writing, and I, as well as taking swipes at the academic life, I also take a few swipes at the writing life, so this is that. This is Ruth trying to write. The proverbial blank white page, Ruth was thinking, could hardly be more daunting than an empty computer screen. You looked at the page, but into the screen, that deep blue domain with its illusion of gelatinous depth that made her think of the farthest reaches of deep space. Not the deep space of the mind, but the deep space of space, where there was no oxygen and a dead astronaut who'd come untethered from a space station could go spinning head over heels for all eternity. Just right. She got up from her desk and gathered all the loose papers in her study and placed them in file folders and stood them in the holder Ben had given her in one of his periodic attempts to help her get organized. Then she moved to the downstairs half bath where she scrubbed the sink with Ajax and French braided portions of her hair. After that, she spent some minutes in the kitchen stuffing handfuls of dry cereal into her mouth as she waited for water to heat up for postum, a suitably pointless beverage to which she was reverting only because she'd drunk it during what had seemed at the time like a fruitful writing period several years ago. Just right, but not about the dead astronaut. That's the kind of thing a stone sophomore up against a deadline would write. Do an exercise, one of those exercises she made her students do when she ran out of ways to fill time in a workshop. Do the automatic writing thing. 10 minutes of continuous action of the fingers on the keyboard. Doesn't matter what, she told them. Write the same word over and over if you must. Prime the pump. Send the bucket down, haul the bucket up. She checked the clock. 10:27, a discouragingly indefinite starting point. Better wait for the half hour. She took 3 minutes to check the headlines on the CNN website, half hoping to find that 6 bombs had gone off simultaneously in the holds of six planes flying over the Atlantic. Not that she required anything as calamitous as that. Just some piece of breaking news, lurid and large-scale enough to serve as an occasion for amazed procrastination. When the page opened, she saw that the lead story was the approach of Hurricane Heather, just as it had been for the past 3 days. Her heart rose momentarily when she saw how much larger the whirling blender blade had grown and how much progress it had made across the Gulf of Mexico. But then she noticed that the wide pink wedge radiating out from it had shifted disappointingly to the east. Heather Hops was the headline. According to Spangler meteorologist Roush Spanier, Spangler and the East Texas coast will likely be spared Heather's worst. We can't be 100% sure, but this morning nearly all our models are telling us Heather will come right up to our front door and then do a dog leg and pay the folks in western Louisiana a visit. 10:30, back to the screen. Just right, just right, just right. About what? About what? About a man getting on a bus somewhere in the Midwest. A lean, graying man in a cheap windbreaker who's been forced to leave the family farm to get a job in Omaha. And as he settles into his seat, he's thinking about his widowed mother, or maybe it's his wife, and the cows in the barn, and the chickens in the what do you call it? The hen house. The hen house. Why was it that under the pressure of this exercise, which should have squeezed something authentic out of her, she'd come up with a subject she knew nothing about, an alien style that couldn't be further from her own, as if she were channeling some hack? And how was she to perform the required dredging of her memory and imagination? It wasn't as if she kept an actual tool in her mind she could use to do the job. And of course, there was no excavation site in there either, only slimy, furrowed tissue. As far as I'll go.
I'm going to be your David Frost tonight.
No, that's not good.
Well, I'm going to open with the softball question, which is about memoir to fiction. You made the transition from memoir to fiction and personal essay to fiction. So was it liberating or was it surprising?
It was liberating. But it was also not all that different. It's a cliche to say there's a lot of fiction in memoirs, but there's also a lot of fictional technique in memoirs. So it's not all that different. But what was different is, I can't shake. I've never been able quite to shake what Philip Lopate calls the shame of the sort of stain of autobiographical writing, the stench of self, and the sense that there's always there's always some terrible compromise that you make, whether you're sure you're not ever entirely sure you have or not. And so it was just, and I've gotten in big trouble with my family over things I've said in memoirs, and I'm looking forward with a great sense of sort of liberation and relief to the idea that I won't get in trouble with anybody, except possibly my husband's graduate students, who I describe in a less than flattering way.
Well, you take on philosophers and the whole philosophy department.
Yeah, but they get the roughest treatment, really, and it's really not fair because I'm talking about an earlier generation. When I signed books in Houston recently, I wrote "Please don't be offended" over and over again in the
But why are philosophers and professors of philosophy such a easy target for your comedy? Because the book is so funny. You know, that's what, for me, that's what, having read it several times in this process, that was always a great barometer that I was still laughing at things on the third and fourth reading.
Yeah, well, they are funny. I mean, they're getting less so all the time. I have thought for years that, for example, the American Philosophical Association's yearly convention is one of the funniest things. That is just almost pure comedy.
I guess we should identify that your husband is a professor of philosophy at Rice.
Yeah, right.
So you've been a career faculty wife
after being a career faculty brat. Yeah. No, but they are getting civilized and socialized in a way that makes them more like members of the MLA than the they know how to talk. They know how to enter conversations and get out of conversations. Their hygiene has improved.
In the book, you say that dandruff was always a feature.
Yeah, that was like that. You know, I was horrified to realize that we just went to Philadelphia this past after Christmas, and that was the 25th one I've been to, and the 35th in a row that my husband has been to. So it's quite a longitudinal experience to go to those things.
But you've also written in the essay form about being a faculty wife and about being a faculty brat, and that's those obviously the faculty. Ruth Blau is a faculty wife in here, and I imagine everybody wanted to know how much of Ruth was in you, and you in Ruth, and
no more softballs. There's a lot of Ruth in me, but I did take this is a pure pleasure of writing fiction. I made her tall and thin, which and I hope I'm not as drunk as she as frequently as she is, and I hope I'm not quite as embittered, but she is very much me. It's funny, I had a conversation with a friend about that, the idea of, she was telling me that it was disturbing or distorting, I guess, to read a fictional version of somebody she knew well, and it was hard for her to judge, the success of this portrayal. So I've been sort of thinking about that. Is that an answer?
Yeah. Enough of an answer. the faculty wife essay was one of the first essays of yours I read, uh-huh. and it was so memorable, and it captured so amazingly that generational shift too, about the faculty wives of your mother's generation who were kind of the avant-garde who served arugula and wore batik prints. And
not arugula, it was endive.
Endive.
They hadn't gone to arugula yet.
But what's happened to that woman generationally? Who are your peers now as faculty wives?
The role has disappeared, just about. I mean, there are a few my age, but they're usually women in hiding in some way or other who were making, it's no longer an honorable.
They were content then. That's the picture.
Well, weren't content, they had a role that they really don't have anymore, and it's a hiding place now, I think, for some women. And it's, in women younger than me, it's gone. It's no longer a place. There's no longer a place for it.
So the catalyst in your novel is Risha Spottiswood, who is an ethereal memoirist, mm-hmm. right? Poetess and memoirist.
Yeah. And former poetess.
And yeah. she has a spouse who's kind of her faculty wife in a way, Charles. Yeah. But there wasn't really a male counterpart, or there isn't really a male counterpart to that role.
No. Although in some ways he's hiding in that role himself. I think he's a character I love and find very. He really has no counterpart in life, but I find him just enormously attractive for some reason. He is hiding from the failure of his life essentially in his role as faculty spouse. So in some ways it transcends gender.
But Risha comes, she's a visiting writer and as I said, it has a kind of catalyzing effect on Ruth and the community there. Charles does too.
Yeah.
And is that general disturbance what often happens from the visiting writers or writers in residence? Does it disturb that environment?
I don't think that's really kind of a I think I get into kind of comic opera or something there, and it doesn't represent anything that I've seen happen. What usually happens is that visiting writers arrive and then they teach classes and they don't do and they disappear. I mean, they very often have almost no impact on on academic life. So that was, unless, I mean, Risha has glamour and fame, but that would have faded, in a real situation, that would have faded very fast. Because there's nothing like academic life to fade things, I think.
So you teach writing students at the University of Texas?
No, at Rice. Yeah.
And now at Rice.
Yeah.
And are they fiction students or are they?
They are personal essay students because that is my the genre that I love best and identify with the most and feel that I can teach. I don't feel I could teach fiction after having written this novel.
But why is personal essay your favorite form?
It's my favorite form because because it was the form that got me really started as a writer. I 15 years ago I was a student in the writing program at the university, the very distinguished writing program at the University of Houston, and I studied with the wonderful writer and teacher Rosalind Brown, and I had written nothing but fiction, and it was perfectly respectable fiction, but just not very interesting. It was competent, but not very interesting. And Rose Allen took me aside after a fiction workshop at the end of the semester, after a fiction workshop, and said, "I think you're an essayist." And this was an entirely new. What? You know, it was like, "I think you're a taxidermist." It was completely foreign to me. And I really had no notion of that being a possibility. But then, just she invited me to enroll in the personal essay workshop she was teaching the next semester. And it happened that just then Philip Lopate's Art of the Personal Essay came out, and it was a wonderful kind of, this is kind of the perfect storm that I'd been waiting for all my life. And I read Philip's introduction to the Art of the Personal Essay, and I don't know if any of you have read this. It's in itself a wonderful essay, and a kind of sui generis piece of writing that's not just a history of the genre, but a sort of psychological portrait of the personal essayist, of the kind of person who is drawn to this form. And I really, I mean, it was a real eureka moment, because I thought, that's me. That is me. I mean, there was a phrase in there about how personal essayists are rarely, I forget the exact words, but rarely sort of solid, well-adjusted, comfortable with themselves types. And I thought, that sounds familiar. I started writing personal essays and publishing them, and that was for me the start of my writing.
And what kind of distinction do you make, or personally, between memoir and personal essay? How would you distinguish between the two?
Well, I think what's sort of commonly understood is that they are very close to one another, and that the personal essay is sort of, among other things, is the short form of the memoir. But I think they differ in a lot of other ways. I wrote an essay, actually, about the difference between the personal essay and the memoir, and how the memoir introduces, memoir having to cover a lot of pages, introduces a narrative arc that somehow makes it impossible to do many of the wonderful little maneuvers that you can do in personal essay, the kind of twists and turns and reflexive turning back on and examining what you've just said. It discourages that. Of course, it doesn't entirely rule it out, but it's very easy in a memoir to get on that kind of royal narrative road and get away from the wonderful introspective capabilities of personal essay.
We were talking earlier today about how you were not as comfortable in a short form essay as you were in a personal essay, you said, because personal essay kind of demands that meandering.
Yeah. Well, that may be only me, but I seem to, I've tried very hard for reasons of, you know, career reasons to write short pieces that could herald, you know, books and stuff, and I just keep not being able to do it. It's like I lose my voice in a short form, and I sound kind of chirpy and journalistic and unrecognizable to myself. So I, you know, that sounds like a form of sort of inverted boasting, but, and maybe it is, but I do feel I need, I'm not all that long-winded either, but I need that sort of 32 pages to move around in.
And what kind of, because of course memoirs are so celebrated and are on the bestseller list these days, yeah. and much in the news, true or not true, what kind of writing student chooses to take a class in personal essay now versus any other kind of creative writing? What do you, is it, can you draw any kind of conclusion about this generation from what you see among your students?
My students, I actually am at the moment teaching at Rice, and I have had the luck this semester, which will be my last semester at Rice because the dean is kicking me out because I'm a part-timer and part-timers are no longer welcome and because for economic reasons that is completely counterintuitive. You'd think that they'd be a lot cheaper, but anyway, I won't get off on that. I have seven girls who are wonderful and have this marvelous kind of rapport and write for each other. And they are, I don't think they knew what they were getting into with personal essay. I try to convey the form at the same time that by having them read widely and in the form, as well as having them write. I think it's true that older people have a real advantage in this form because it has so much to do with objectivity and perspective and distance. But younger people can really use it too. And they also have they have their own advantage, which is memory, real, you know, accurate memory. And they haven't mythologized their lives yet. It's interesting to see them kind of making interim sense of their lives as they stand. And you see them, you know, kind of arriving at insights that they might not have. I mean, I don't really like the notion of this kind of writing as therapy, but it certainly is insight producing, which is a different thing. It's a delight to teach, particularly this group. It's a sort of charmed group, and I'm sorry that's my last at Rice.
Do they need? Do they feel kind of slavishly tied to the truth, or do
they
take liberties?
They're over conscientious about. I have to liberate them from being too literal minded.
Well, what's your position on it?
My position is that I wish I could quote. I wrote a little piece about that. Philip Lopate, my position is Philip Lopate's position, as it almost always is, which is that too much is made of literal, you know, keeping to the literal truth. An autobiographical writer, whether a memoirist or a personal essayist, has plenty of room to invent. But of course, you know, then there are people who abuse who really ruin it for autobiographical writers, you know, notoriously have done that. But my students have struggled to find a balance and to feel free enough to have the literary freedom to invent within, you know, reasonable bounds. And so I try to give them that sense of balance by through reading and through pointing out, you know, where probably invention came into play.
So the passage that you read about Ruth going through her, going through the various stations before she could actually write, was that your process too? Did you connect to her?
Process. It's a pre-process.
But I mean, did you? You know, I mean, there's a certain amount of dread and spinning of wheels and. Did you feel like that as you approached the novel, or did it?
I felt that way. I didn't actually feel that way about this novel. I felt terribly cowed by the idea of writing a novel, just because I had so much identified myself as a nonfiction writer, and I realized I would have to really pick my spots to write a successful novel. That I was not going to be able to write a big naturalistic sprawling canvas kind of novel. I wasn't going to write The Shipping News or anything like that. I had reached a point of maturity as a writer where I kind of eliminated what I couldn't do and got a sense for the kind of range of things I could do, and my confidence increased. But I didn't have it that. I had nothing, almost nothing, but fun writing this novel.
Which brings me to the next question, which is that the names in the book are very funny and inventive and sound kind of uncannily real and possible. You know, there's Dean Mittenkurtz, Roberta Mittenkurtz, and the school itself is the Lola Dees Institute. Yeah. And I read somewhere in all of this that you and your husband, George, the professor of philosophy at Rice, would take these long walks and crack each other up with the coming up with these names.
He is to be credited with maybe three quarters of those names. And he's got a genius for names. And I thought the Lola Dees Institute was just brilliant. It just came out of his.
It doesn't reference anything.
No, but it just sounds. Doesn't it sound Southern? I mean, it just
absolutely.
Sounds,
Spangler, Texas sounds like
that. Was also his.
I can see the little star in the map.
No, he was. He wants to be to get credit too. He got annoyed at me for not giving him enough credit at the last reading I gave. So, unfortunately, he's not here now. But I can at least tell him that he got credit. Also, not just names. I mean, it was. I think that comic writing is enormously collaborative.
Did your novel have to be set on a Southern college campus? I mean, were there certain irresistible things that come with life in the Southern brand of a university, that because you grew up on the Williams College campus, so you've got the Northeastern version of it. And is there in choosing a setting, was it more fertile ground to set it in the South?
Well, it was. It in some ways, I think it was less fertile ground because but it had the great advantage of being right there for me to use. And I think I have not a particularly great visual imagination, and I just stole that campus and because I didn't feel secure about imagining a campus. But living in a city which is really kind of my adopted city of Houston, which a city that I'm quite fond of, I sort of wanted to, I don't know, pay it tribute. I don't really pay it tribute, but I wanted to acknowledge it in some way. I wanted to talk about how the place struck me and how in particular Rice University struck me, and I think it's not an entirely unaffectionate portrait.
Thank you very much for coming. Emily
will right on the
signed copy.
Thanks for joining us on Book Tour. For more readings and discussions like this one, please visit npr.org/booktour.